Everybody, welcome to Book Tales with Ran Dugat and Heather Fowler. Today, we are delighted to feature Christine Kwan, author of A Ribbon the Most Perfect Blue, published by Southeast Missouri State University Press.
Book Tales, Readings, Cocktail, and Crafts is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. Why cocktails? We thought that having a drink while listening to your favorite author chat and give a reading would be a fun idea. Today, we are drinking City Park Sour AF, inspired by Christine's book. The recipe is on the Hot Redhead Media blog, link in the podcast description if you'd like to make it and have one with us.
Christine Kwan is a Korean-American poet and fiction writer. Her debut poetry collection, A Ribbon the Most Perfect Blue, won the Cowles Poetry Book Prize from Southeast Missouri State University Press 2023. She lives in a yellow shotgun house in New Orleans with her husband and their three cats, Trotsky, Lady Murasaki, and Cy Twombly. She is the literary editor at Tilted House Press. Her work has appeared or is soon to appear in The Poetry Project, Hot Pink Mag, Joyland Magazine, The Columbia Review, and others. She attended Yale and the Iowa Writers' Workshop. Of her debut collection we feature today, author Mark Levine says, quote, Christine Kwan has a playfully no-nonsense way with the agitations of being someone's child, someone's partner, someone's poet, someone's self. This voice is fresh, freshly wounded, clear-eyed, laid bare. Woo, strong praise there.
That's amazing. How are you doing today, Christine?
Oh, I'm doing so great. Thank you so much for having me. I love appearing on the airwaves in New Orleans.
Aw.
Yay. Well, hopefully we're going to reach much farther than New Orleans since we have so many venues the podcast comes out in. So maybe you'll even get some new friends from elsewhere. So we're looking forward to talking with you about your work today and also having you give us a reading a little bit later. What's your experience with readings? Do you enjoy giving readings?
I do. I've just been really lucky and just got off a mini book tour, very mini. I read in Los Angeles, New York, and Iowa City, where I went to graduate school. And I also read in Seattle for AWP. And reading is so fun. It really brings out the SAG in me, which is my horoscope sign. It's a performance. But I don't like when poets use their poet voice. I prefer it when they use their normal voice.
There's two different poet voices, right? I mean, let's just dig into this for a second because it's fascinating you said that. There's the spoken word, da-da-da, da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da kind of tonality and when they do things in a really staccato way. And then there's the kind of literary pretentious poet voice, which is a little bit less earthy and authentic. And then I think what you're saying is that you like to have organic rhythms. Is that what I'm hearing?
I like when the poet sounds like themselves in normal life. And what I really rebel against is the kind of the second thing you said, the pretentious kind of intellectual voice. But sometimes I notice people use this even when they go on Terry Gross, even like comedians. I'm just like, wow, you suddenly don't sound like yourself. And yeah, it's not relatable. And I think it kind of makes people zone out a little bit. So I try not to fall into that trap. I really do.
So they're wearing their straight jacket poetry reading voice or something. They're very explicit role switching for that modality voice. That's interesting.
I think that people read things differently than they just say things. And so it's up to the person given the reading to try and find like the middle ground between the two.
Yeah, for sure. You know what I hate? I hate when I read a book of poems and I'm like so in love with the poet. I'm like, oh, this is so amazing. I have to go hear them read. And then I hear them read and I'm like, oh, why did I do that? I heard it so much nicer when I read it on the page. Does that ever happen to anybody else or is this just me?
Sometimes some poems look better on paper and they're better read. And sometimes poems really shine when the poet reads them out loud or somebody reads them out loud, you know?
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about the poems in this collection? And was there one poem that shaped it? And I don't know, how did you put them together and how do they connect?
So I wrote all these poems within 1 year, which is really unusual for a first book of poems, I think. usually a first book of poems is a collection of like that poet's youth, like suffering, just like suffering for about 10 years between, I guess, your whole 20s, maybe your 30s. And then everything you've ever written basically in your childhood makes it to your first book because it's their first big publication. Thankfully, I burned that stage of my life pretty much literally. And I took a long break from writing in general, maybe about 6 or 7 years after my MFA in creative writing. And I was just like, you know, I'm not going to be a writer anymore. It doesn't make any money. And I don't know if I can sacrifice being a normal person with an income and stability. And basically, I suffered probably a bad period of mental health, and it came down to me not writing. So my therapist suggested I start writing again, and I started writing again for about a year, put the poems on Instagram just for my friends. And from that, this book was born.
Oh. So,
yeah, and it's really, all the other poets I know, they just submit their manuscript year after year. I submitted this manuscript only like 3 times before it was accepted for the Cowles Poetry Prize from Southeast Missouri State University. And that's how it was published. But that's a highly unusual path. These poems are like a rebirth or me returning to writing.
Do you think that your MFA program impacted your pause in your writing? One, and number two, just because now we'll have this story for posterity. Was there actually a burning fire you flung poems into? This is so fascinating.
It was more like I walked into the fire and died. And it was definitely like I had to die to be reborn type of thing, where I kind of almost died of humiliation and then was reborn without any kind of humiliation left to be spared. It was like I had nothing left to lose. And I do think with writing, you have to kind of be in that state where you're not afraid of being judged or ridiculed. In fact, every time I go to a poetry reading, there's almost this aspect of being publicly flayed alive or burned at the stake, because it is a little embarrassing. I feel like no matter what, it's always cringe, even if it's like a very famous poet. And I said to myself, you know what? It doesn't matter anymore. I don't care if I die without ever getting published. If no one reads me, I'm going to just live like Emily Dickinson and never leave my house and just do this secret thing. And I don't care anymore. I don't care about being seen. I don't care about being judged. And yeah, I think that's kind of important. It was a healthier way for me to write.
Well, I think also, and thank you for sharing that, and I can connect with a lot of what you're saying, that sometimes in the surrendering, that's when things change.
Yeah, I was waving my white flag.
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah, but then something kind of beautiful occurred. It's like that, what is it? Is it like a Japanese pottery art where you seal the cracks with gold and then you just are stronger as an individual? And actually, I mean, that's pretty amazing, because when you came back to it and you came back to the work with love and you came back to it with the same joy that you wanted to have when you were creating, it sounds to me like this book came out of a piece. So from what you were saying, that probably really matured your outlook to such a point that you felt like you were very much in the flow with creating this book as something that had its own interconnectedness and a really proximity of the pieces to each other, which also gives it its own kind of flair and flavor as a collection, which is really cool. Congrats on that. That's awesome.
Yeah, thank you. And yeah, I think I've also reached a certain level of maturity that allowed this to happen. I mean, I am 34. This book came out when I was 34. It came out like in March. I don't think it could have happened in my 20s. And I consider myself sort of a late bloomer, because everything kind of started exploding for me, like all these publications and appearances like this one. And, you know, it all happened when I was 33, 34. And talking to people, sometimes, you know, people have said to me, oh my God, you give me a lot of hope, because it's not too late to just kind of start again.
Oh yeah, for sure. So here's something else. I mean, whenever I read a book, I always think about it deeply, how it's connecting, how the different pieces of it are working together, what the author is evoking, things like that. And I noticed that there was a lot of literary homage shout out in the book. There were a lot of authors mentioned, like literary forebearers, maybe, of some things that you were doing stylistically and or imagistically. Were you interested in linking to a larger poetic tradition with this? And in what ways might you have wanted to disrupt what you've read in the past and bring yourself to the fore.
Yeah, that's definitely a kind of a theme in the book. And I kind of think of them as literary ghosts that are haunting me, writers from the canon who really affected me and changed me. And I feel that in a way, like they're now judging me. And I do want to be in conversation with the canon, but I have a very tormented relationship with the canon as a minority, and as the canon is very majority white and male. It's a little bit of a tortured relationship. It's love and hate. But I think that even if writers trying to rebel against the canon, I still think you need to be very familiar with it, at least to know what you're rebelling against.
Absolutely. Now, I was feeling Frank O'Hara in some of your poems. A couple of them stylistically were sort of like not this, but that poem, especially All the Witches, number one, reminded me of him. And then I discovered him named later on and Thank You Come Again and Blue Feast. Can you talk about your connection to his poetry?
Yeah, I really thank you for noticing that. That's very complimentary to me. He's one of my favorite poets. And he has a kind of self-effacing charm. Charm is important to me both in poetry and in real life. And sometimes poetry can be utterly charmless. Like if you met a certain poem at a party, you'd be like, no thanks. You know, I'm going to the next person, go to the bathroom and not come back. And Frank O'Hara is just like super charming. If you met him at a party, him or his poetry, it would just be engaging, kind of bubbly, casual. I think being a little casual in poetry, it can go a long way. I don't know, his poetry is very approachable, but also sad. And he has a lot of his daily real life in his poetry. It's not just so highbrow, like intellectual White Tower. Oh, it has a lot of objects and happenings from just like normal life. And I think for me, that's where the bread and butter is, just emotions happening in real life. Not just in super intense moments, but just every day.
Well, that seems like really cool. And it kind of echoes back to what you were saying about poets giving readings, is you like that authentic person in the space, whether it's on the page or it's in the reading voice itself, which is really cool. Something I noticed in this book, which I also noticed in your bio, was the cats. So I noticed that cats feature really prominently in this book, but then there were some kind of recurrent images that kept coming through for me, like cats, beautiful girls, the color of whiteness, the idea of whiteness, peonies, mortality, among other things. Are there what you would consider to be hobby horse kind of symbols in your work that you know mean a lot to you personally and artistically?
That's a great question. And I think that if you look closely at any poet's work, they have a little world of objects that they go back to again and again. Mm. I went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and there was this tradition where a couple poets read, and it's like they're reading, right, at a bar. And the tradition is before the poet goes on to read, another poet comes on to roast them mercilessly. And during my roast.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, during my roast, they were like, oh yeah, Christine's a great poet, but you just have to end every line with grass or leaves. And at the time, that was really true. And if you did just end the line with grass, it really did just sound like me. And if you look at any poet's work, I think you're right on. Flowers, cats, some symbols of nature, girls, beautiful girls, they definitely appear in my work a lot. And I kind of always think of Emily Dickinson. When you read her work, there's always the same little world of objects, bees, flowers, nectar, pollen, insects, a room. And it's like in movies, a little bit of world building. I think poets, through their poems, kind of create their own little space like that, where it's like a Wes Anderson movie. You, just looking at it, you know whose world it is. And I think poets, they do a similar thing with the kind of objects that appear again and again.
That's so interesting. As a non-poet, I find that really interesting how that is another way of doing world building. And another thing that I really loved about your poems were the New Orleans references, being a New Orleanian. So I was always happy to see them, and you just do them so well. I love like the mention of City Park and a Bayou Picnic and even Bar Marilou. How does the place you're living in inform your poetry?
Well, I'll go ahead and say that this book would not exist without New Orleans. It really was born here, entirely written here. And yes, it's like a beautiful city. But for me, more importantly, I needed to be in a place not like New York or LA where I lived in previously, where the first question's like, what's your job? What do you do? How do you make money? In New Orleans, it's always everyone's an artist. And everyone has this job to make money, but that's not what they're doing here. What they're doing here is some type of art form, like puppets or painting or writing poems on the street or whatnot. And this place has a permissibility that made it possible for me to even attempt being a poet at 34. In other cities, I would have been really shunned. And here, no one batted an eye. So I was able to be kind of free and free from judgment and... that's really important. I don't think you can...
difficult to create when you're not in a situation like that.
Right. It's hard to take yourself seriously when you're in some cities that don't have such a deep appreciation of creating.
Oh, for sure. I mean, that's a beautiful place to be, and it's a very artistic vibe and all of that too. So that's exciting. I like about your work, speaking of moving away from the more precise ideas of a place or a certain place, I like how there's sometimes an element of deliberate ambiguity in this book. And as I was reading your book, I was thinking, is it important to you to leave a lot of white space in the reader's mind?
That's funny because I think one of my problems is being maybe too straightforward or too easy to understand. But white space is definitely important in poetry. For that reason, I'm not a huge fan of like prose poetry, even though I have a few prose poems in here. Poetry requires a lot of imagination from the reader. It's a kind of very active participation, more so than prose, I'd say, because when someone's reading a poem, you kind of have to bring your own experiences to it. And all poetry workshops are like, what do you think this poem means? And that's kind of different from how prose operates. So yeah, I think allowing for some white space and leaving some things unsaid is really important.
So for those who are just starting to write poetry, for some of our listeners who are new to writing poetry, I was wondering if you could explain your choice of form a little bit. Like, how do you make the decision of what form or shape your words will take? Is it something you know when you start out, or do you play with it after you've captured your words and ideas? How do you do that?
It's often an idea that is formed in the beginning. Very rarely do I write a poem and then change its form. Form is super critical. I think it can really change meaning. So, for instance, in one of my poems called Lazy Boy, my father is kind of compared to a chair, and a reader can read into that what they will. But more importantly, the poem kind of ends with the poet almost being kind of in an unescapable room. And the poem itself is just like in a solid prose block shape. And there's something about like that form really working well with the content. So I think it's super important to think about different forms as you're kind of writing, playing with the form as you're writing in the beginning. But you can also change it in the end.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Do you ever do, I used to do a lot of poetry marathons where I'd do a different form a day for like a month or something like that. And we would do like heroic sonnets. We'd do like, you know, ghazals, villanelle, like all kinds of different forms like that. Have you ever been drawn to doing a book full of formal, like with rhyme schemes and various syllabic counts and stuff like that? Have you ever been drawn to that sort of formal poetry writing?
I think that's really fun, very useful. And I would like to be more formal, but that is not my strong suit, I think.
Well, you know, there's a people may never do it their whole life, or they may just love it, or they may do it for one project and that's it.
No, so. I love it and I try it a lot. It's like baking. You have to be very precise. I like to bake, but the results aren't good. Yeah, there's something in my personality that doesn't allow me to really follow the form. But I think learning form and trying different forms is very critical to a poet's development because it kind of forces you to think in ways you normally wouldn't.
Yeah, and I think sometimes it creates different content than you would generate because you're using different words than you would. And then the whole stream of the poem goes in a direction that you wouldn't have anticipated because of the structure that you create, which is kind of cool. Speaking of which, connectedly, what draws you to poetry as a genre? What do you love about it? What do you hate about it? about it? And when do you choose to write in poetry as opposed to writing fiction?
Well, they're different urges. I only write fiction when a story occurs to me and I write the story. I don't write fiction to hear myself talk because I feel like being descriptive or something. I only start a story when it's like, ooh, that's a good plot for a story. And I think my stories and my poetry are very different. My poems kind of have a different birth. They are usually, they're started with a phrase, a mood, some kind of abstract idea, comparing something to something else. They call to me differently. If I were born again and I was given a choice, would you like to be a poet or a fiction writer? I would say, please, please make me a fiction writer. Like, poetry is actually something I tried to leave behind, and unfortunately, there's just a poet inside me. And when it comes down to it, the thing that I can't stop writing, or the way I naturally think, is poetry. Not to say I'm better at one than the other, but I think my personality and my brain is just naturally, I'm a poet. I don't know. What can I say?
I don't think there's anything wrong with ranking your genres with being like, this is my first love. This is my weekend lover. This is, why not?
Sure.
At least you know yourself to that extent.
I wish my full-time partner were fiction. I really do. That is a more lucrative and wider reaching thing these days. Yeah, I can't really change what's...
who you are.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. The color blue features largely throughout your collection in the title and several poems. And I was wondering what drew you to this color, and if you could talk a little bit about your decision to use it as a thread or a ribbon running through your poems.
It's just the color that affects me most emotionally. And ever since I was little, when the sky starts turning the blue before night, I don't know what to say. My soul starts singing. I'm just like, uh-oh, this is what it means to be alive. Oh my God, what's happening? I'm really affected by it.
Are you drawn to it in like your decor and your clothing as well?
No, it really haunts me. The loss of day into night, that kind of transitional blue every day, it has always really affected me, even since I was little. And I always tried to explain it. It's almost like, it's very sad to me. There's an element of mourning there, but it's also, I feel that in the day, things kind of have a dusty blur on them. You're blinded by the sunshiny day. But in that night, there's kind of this inevitability, like it might always be night. But in that one transitory blue time of evening, I feel like I can see everything with clarity. I feel like I see the detail on everything. It's just like, I don't know, it's very strange.
I get that. I understand it.
And I just have an emotional reaction to that color. I think that's why it appears in my poems. And yeah, it's definitely the color I return to.
Oh, sure. And I'd venture to say that it's popularized in American culture as like the color of exquisite sadness. Mm-hmm. Maybe other cultures too. But I mean, I think they say you get the blues. Look at linguistically how blue appears and so much stuff like that too. So I wonder if that's like a little subliminal echo for you. All of the ways in which our culture or any shared culture tends to use that color.
Yeah, I agree. The funny thing is, personality-wise, I'm very chipper. I'm a very happy, go-lucky, bubbly person, but...
Yeah, and then you go to the page and you're like, here's the horror of the world. No, I'm just kidding.
It might be, but yeah, I don't know. Yeah, that color really like pierces through my exterior. That's all I can say about it.
Yeah, so interesting. Well, Ran, can you tell us about today's drink?
Sure. Today's alcohol-free cocktail is called City Park Sour AF, which the AF stands for alcohol-free or whatever you choose for it to stand for. The recipe's on the blog if you'd like to make a drink and enjoy it while you listen at home. Here are the ingredients. It's 3 ounces of pineapple juice, 1 ounce of lemon juice, 1/2 ounce of cherry juice, 1/2 ounce of orgeat syrup, or a few drops of almond extract. Put everything in a shaker with ice. Give it a shake. Strain it into a rocks glass filled with ice and garnish with a cherry. If you would prefer alcohol, you can change the amaretto for the syrup.
That sounds delicious. And when I am drinking, that's something I definitely go for. I think I told Ran, I was like,
you did. That's why I did it.
I was like amaretto sours. I know it's trashy, but I can't help myself.
We love what we love.
I know, the heart wants what the heart wants.
Yes.
And the reason we have sour AF right now without alcohol, though, is I am pregnant.
Oh, okay.
It's a crazy thing to say in a podcast.
Congratulations. When are you due?
I'm due in November. And it's funny that I'm saying this here because I've told maybe 10 people in real life. Even though I'm 7 months along, I just like it doesn't occur to me to ever say it. Yeah. So I have only 3 months left, but I think it might be really nice that I put it here for posterity.
Cool.
With the baby and be like, look, there's you.
Oh, I love that. That's so cool.
Yeah.
Yay. Well, would you like to tell us a little bit about the excerpt that you've selected to read for us today?
I'm going
to
read a few poems from my book, A Rib of the Most Perfect Blue, came out a couple of months ago. And then I'm going to end with a couple of new poems.
Oh, okay.
Oh, look at that. That's exciting. We have a special new poems.
Very exciting. Okay, well, go ahead whenever you're ready.
All right. Today I was elegant. I could have been a lawyer. I would have been a wonderful doctor. This is what the morning sun tells me, streaming into my heart. Instead, I get lunch with my friend who is a lawyer and my friend who is a doctor, a large fern flickering over my face. I am wearing a long sheer dress meant for the beach. I'm happy, I say, though I meant to tell the truth. How at night the moon acts like a crazy girl slapping my face left and right. Instead, I watch children play after school. I am paid by the hour. I take a long time getting ready to go out. As I paint my face, I feel like a geisha preparing a tea service, every movement an art. Now that I don't go out often, at the house party, what I say and who I am surprises me. Like horses passing each other on a road, I pass a stranger in the hall. We dip our heads shyly, and all night long is a silver thread. Girls on bikes. Because there's a lot of girls on bikes biking around New Orleans. So that's where this poem comes from. The girls I know talk to me about their bicycle being stolen, not being able to bike to meet me somewhere, the difficulties of biking, the men that holler at them as they're biking, the bush they biked into. But they do not tell me about their baby. The girls on their bikes are beautiful. Not that there is no baby. The girls I know are women. And where there are women, there is a baby hiding somewhere. Glancing at my friend as she leans over her notebook, I see the mommy and turn away, embarrassed. I woke up from a nap once, crying, "Mommy, mommy." My husband was there and he thought it was cute, but he was not my mommy. The linoleum floor that must be ripped up is mommy. The whitish spots on the bathroom mirror are freckles on her face. Sometimes my mommy turns black, but she cannot be amputated. I am a mommy in the mirror, and I have the blues. I woke up with blues fluttering. Yesterday and the day before yesterday was another yesterday that rode past like a baby on a bike waving hello. There never having been a baby, is a baby, crying in its cradle in the corner of the room. Do we not have babies because we have bikes? There just seems to be this weird breed of beautiful women biking, their baskets filled with flowers and books, sipping iced coffees like furious bees. We talk about nothing except whether or not to bike. I am going to read a cat poem because we talked about cats today. Le Friday. In a Friday, trying not to let go of it, I lay down on the altar. If I could wake up from this dream, not eat today, not feed the cats, not go to Lowe's, I thought I might give birth to a calla. Friday, 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 my heart cried, holding on like a cat to a string of sun. I lay Friday down, brush her hair, hold her purring in my arms. Still she dies, the week dies, the year dies, and I lie reading. Bolt up from the striped day bed. Doctors shout from the other room. It's going to be a calla, but it's not mine. It has your nose, your eyes. No mask. And it's spelled N-O-H, like Japanese no theater. And those masks are cool because, you know, masks don't change, they're a mask. But depending on how you tilt that mask up and down and left to right, it can appear like it's smiling, like it's angry. But obviously when you say no mask in English out loud, it can also mean that you have no mask on. So, no mask. I will no longer shed my poetic countenance. I will proudly tie it to my face before I go out. I liked it so much being young. Fortunately, I'm quite dead now. Fortunately, I have two faces. In one light, I'm smiling. From certain angles, I'm not. Like Prada slip-ons politely folding over a pope's feet, my body crackles. Inside, I am taking pictures. Sometimes I am dying too. But unlike the body, I come back a little young again, blithely buying one entrance ticket to the garden. Sometimes my husband tells me, without telling me, to get a job. Hands crossed at my sacrum, I pace. Does he not see the altar in the living room? That eating pasta, I am already dead. Just two more from the book. One is very short. Ralph Lauren. What is night but a list of complaints? Mother arriving in crisp Ralph Lauren and tailored pants. Her eyes, her mouth, her hands. They say when you cut into night, there is no fat, only bone. And the last poem from the book is a New Orleans poem. It's called Some Lake. In the French Quarter, behind horse and buggy, listening to Adele, I am quiet in my car. If I'm being totally honest, I don't even like Adele, but listening to Adele, I know all the words. My friend told me not to take the quarter. I'd be behind horse and buggy the whole way, but listening to Adele, I forgot and had to take the quarter. I nod at the tourist listening to Adele. I hear a bachelorette shrieking, "Someone like you is still vomiting. Is it Michelle?" Listening to the sounds of my car beneath Adele, I realize I have grown a mollusk shell, that really I'm hearing the roaring of the sea. They've added bags to the horse's butt for the shit to drop. It was a collective decision. All the horses have the butt bag. Listening to Adele, I wonder why I like all the things you like even when you are not there. Why am I listening to Adele? When I prefer Chet Baker and Julie London, why is your CD in my car? Why is the CD Some Lake I go into again and again, because it is there. Listening to Adele, I am listening and not listening regarding the glistening haunches strain as the horse goes into the bag. And I'm going to end on just a couple of new poems. This poem is called Little John. On the way home from work in New Orleans, there's this funeral home called Little John, and it's kind of overgrown with weeds and stuff. And that was the inspiration for this poem. Little John. In the future, when the Peggy Martins and Jasmine have arched over, feet sliding on moss and the white camellias and the red camellias don't look so haunting, all alone standing there like ghosts. In the future, the little stones, the weeds, the butterflies, the fuzzy black caterpillars will all be organized neatly with nicely watercolored, with tiny script below them. Little John, this I can promise you. Perhaps if you are tired of waiting, you might become a little tuft of grass or a glass of water at night. But I'm coming for you, Little John. So are all the beautiful women riding bicycles and the handsome young men with their sleeves rolled up and a piercing through their nose like a bull. We will stop organizing our records and going to protest and complaining about rent and come get you, Little John. And I have two more. Marie. I have lunch with Marie. I love eating with women and walking with them through the city, looking into houses or stopping to take pictures of a hawk. The pictures will go nowhere, nor will we delete them, but it is better than forgetting the hawk absolutely. Today Marie is sad, though her dark hair falls in perfect waves. She is pale, she is beyond blushing. Her voice is a fountain, a whole girl's choir gurgling. It's many voices at once, Italian and Chinese and Ethiopian and French, and it tumbles over the cool white tablecloth. We don't have her salads and steak tartare yet to distract us, to comfort us, and she's alone and wanting to be loved and not being loved how she wants. And I don't really understand, because I've always been loved, worshipped, and adored. My secret weapon to poverty and disgrace, I live in a house of love. And the women I love know this, they're drawn to it. They do not want more of their kind, they rather eat with me, shop with me. They notice if I carry a linen tote or string bag for the vegetables, though alone I just carry everything in my arms, and alone I don't even think of anything besides croissants, bread and butter, chocolate, cheese. When I am with women, I am a different woman. With Marie, I am like her, elegant and scared. With Coral, I pretend to love to walk, because I do love to walk with her, so sprightly and noticing. And with Heather, I am self-conscious about her magazine glossy hair and skin. It seems to me to be irrefutable evidence of high breeding, like the air and blood and water inside her is so clean, without a wisp of despair. I publish Sophia's poems, though she lives in Mexico City, and I have not seen her in 5 years. In pictures, she still looks beautiful. I think we are entering the marvelous time where we are forming our final face, but still look young. How lovely it is to shed all awkwardness, baby fat, and baby hairs, and look like women. And talk about affairs, jobs, men, children, nothing yet decided, not really. Not when we still love each other. Other women, I mean. Before that goes away. Falls from us like a dress. And this last poem is called Resignation Syndrome. It is about City Park in New Orleans. Kind of. And it's about being a teacher, which I am. My husband and I are both teachers, and we have been for a few years here. Resignation Syndrome. It's so hot, the swamp is rotting. Why have all the swan boats not flown away? Why are the white herons not flying wherever they go to desert us? Forget script, the children don't know their last names. They take up the whole page as if the universe is pulling them apart. After the parade, the son of a cop ran down 9 bikers. I walked past their bodies on the ground. The same season, a woman was severed in half. She was picking up beads thrown from a masked rider. The bedsheet the cops tented over her quickly bloomed red. No more spring or fall. There are 2 seasons now. Red flames or blue flames, hot or icy hot. Why do the hairless squirrels chase one another up the tree? Soon no more acorns, flowers, bees. I stop the child from stamping out a caterpillar. There'll be nothing to eat up your body when you're dead, I said. The only thing worse than rotting is not rotting. No hole for the soul to escape from. I'm the best kind of teacher. Just bring us the beignets and frozen coffees and syrupy ice. What matter if our eyes and feet and hands rot still attached? If our feet crystallize white dust like uber-sweet fruit. It's not like we go for a walk. Let's stay home and grade the students' papers. They don't know left from right or how to tie their shoes. When they grow up, they want to be viral stars. Maybe they will sprout tentacles where their hands and feet used to be, and the shoe industry will boom, and we will only see what's visible in blue light. No one has children anymore anyway. There's no one left to teach them. All the teachers have perished under the bridges. The mayor moved their tents from the park. When they approach my car, I fiddle with the radio. Refugee children in Sweden have fallen into comas and won't wake up. They're perfectly healthy otherwise, sleeping beauties waiting. Once their parents gain citizenship, they wake up and go to school. What a terrible dream, they say, blinking like goldfish. I'm in such a state, I'm planning on being absent, absent, absent. Thank you so much.
Those were great. I love the last one, especially. As a teacher, I can relate.
Yeah, that was mesmerizing. Wonderful. Can you tell us if you have any new projects or artistic directions slated that are coming up?
Well, I am working on a book of short stories currently, and okay. I'm also working on a second manuscript of poems.
That's exciting.
Yeah, neither is finished yet, but I hope they will come into the world one day soon.
So what advice would you offer to, let's just focus on poets for right now, but new poets, both with regard to craft and to getting published?
It's really just about resiliency. If you are resilient, one day I think you will crack the glass and make it. But it is very hard to persevere. And more than talent or even publication, that's the hardest thing, just persevering. And yeah, to better yourself and perfect your craft, even when no one is telling you to do that, right? So my advice is just to become very resilient.
Yeah, that's definitely needed. And connected to that, though, do you have any advice for them in terms of editing work when they're in the midst of that submission process?
I think that it's important to take a little bit of time after you've written something. You don't want to edit something when it's super fresh. I think you need to give it a couple of months to not look at it and come back to it a little bit fresh so that you're not so attached to it. And for a little bit more practical advice, submission, it really helped me when someone told me it is a numbers game. The more you submit, the more you will be accepted. And to be very practical, a good rule of thumb is in submittable to always have at least like 20 to 3 ongoing submissions at a time. So when you dip below that number, to submit again.
Yeah, that's a great specific suggestion. It is. I believe it is a numbers game too. And you definitely have to almost be clinical about it.
You do. Yeah. When I stopped being emotional about that and I was just like, okay, got to do 5 more today, then that's when the tide started shifting. Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you so much for spending time with us today at Book Tales. We really, really enjoyed talking with you and hearing you read your poems.
This has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much, Heather and Ran. I had so much fun.
This has been awesome. Our pleasure. Yes. And everybody, please order Christine's book, A Ribbon the Most Perfect Blue. And be sure to check out www.hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on the Book Tales readings and drinks. Also, subscribe to this podcast, which releases once a month for more conversations with amazing literary authors. Thanks again for listening to Book Tales. See you next time.